This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Around the country, schools are becoming more sensitive and proactive about the problem of bullying. But there are places in schools where there is hidden bullying, or even worse, bullying that's expected and accepted.
Bullying occurs in sports teams. It is not as prevalent on sports teams, but it does occur when coaches don't set the parameters properly.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the issue of bullying on school sports teams. Then we'll head to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where a battle is brewing over a proposed charter school that hopes to raise test scores for minority students. And we'll also spend an academic minute hearing how going green is putting some companies in the black. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Bullying has been a problem in schools, well, for pretty much as long as there have been schools. And thankfully, the problem is beginning to get a lot of attention. But there is a place in schools where there can be hidden bullying, sports teams. Here to talk about this issue is Dr. Cleet Bulock. Dr. Bulock has 40 years of experience in public education and a doctoral degree in social psychology, educational leadership, and curriculum. The second edition of his book, Creating a Culture for High-Performing Schools, a comprehensive approach to school reform and dropout prevention, is currently in print and focuses on how to create a high-performing school culture. Dr. Bulock, this is a bit of a surprising topic for me. I think the conventional wisdom is that if there was bullying involving school sports teams, it would be the athletes against the other smaller students.
Yeah, there's truth in that. It is more likely to occur that way. Bullying occurs in schools. It's more prevalent in schools. It does occur on sports teams. It is not as prevalent on sports teams, but it does occur when coaches don't set the parameters properly. A good coach will get together with the team before anything happens and have a "we agree" session with the team. Here's what successful leaders do. They give control without giving it up. A coach cannot give up control of the team. But somehow the coach has to create a culture or a climate where the team feels like they have some control over what happens with the team. Just as principals cannot give up control of the school, teachers cannot give up control of the classroom, parents cannot give up control of the family. But they have to give some feeling that the others have control without giving it up, okay? So the "we agree" session is where the coach gives control to the team without giving it up. And he says, "Okay, guys, can we agree that it's all for one and one for all?" If that occurs, bullying cannot exist, because if any kid on the team attempts to bully one of the other kids, the team will step in and stop it. All for one and one for all. Most coaches will do that, but not all coaches do it.
Is this an important question that parents should ask their children as they're beginning on sports teams? Has the coach mentioned this?
That would be a good thing. Yeah, that'd be great. Has the coach had a "we agree" meeting? What are the goals of the team? How many games do they want to win? How many games do they think they can win? The rules need to be set down at this "we agree" meeting on how the coach is going to treat the team. One of the ways you can give control without giving it up is an expectations diagnosis. This is covered in Chapter 1 in my book. And it applies to coaches, it applies to parents, it applies to anyone who's a leader, and a coach, of course, is a leader. The coach goes to the team and says, "What do you guys expect of me as your coach?" And this can be a discussion that the team talks about with the coach, or I prefer a 3x5 cards. The coach gives 3 3x5 cards to every member of the team. Okay, and the coach says, "Write one expectation you have of me as your coach on each 3x5 card." Okay, so the coach has got maybe 20 players, depending on the sport, and they will get back. Each 3x5 card will have an expectation the players have of the coach. And here's the coach giving control to the players, has not given it up. "I just want to know what you expect of me as your coach." And and he finds out what the players expect. We call this the existing culture that exists on the team. What do they value and believe should happen? What do the players value and believe should happen? So the coach knows what the kids expect and can shape his coaching style to their expectations. Because if you're an inner city school, the expectations of the kids may be different. If you've got a mix of different minorities on your team, they may have different expectations. Most coaches do not do this, and they really should do it. In our book, I described that all principals should ask their faculty, what do you expect of me as your principal? The teachers go to the kids and say, what do you expect of me as your teacher? And find out. See, what happens is, how do you come across, if you're a leader, how do you come across to the people you're leading? Do you come across as self-serving, or do you come across as there to meet their needs? And that's very important. If you come across to them that you are there to serve them, but you're not going to give up control, you're in a much stronger leadership position. That will reduce bullying behavior big time.
Well, you've spoken about, you know, what a good coach will do. Well, the reason we call them good coaches is because there are some bad ones. If a coach does not take this tack, what can a student do or a student athlete do if there is some bullying occurring?
Unfortunately, coaches, we have control freaks out there who themselves are bullies. And there really isn't a lot a player can do. You can talk to your parents and have the parents go to the principal or to whoever is over the coach. A coach has 9 forms of power, okay? 4 of the forms of power are controlling forms of power. 5 of the forms of power give control without giving it up. For example, the coach demonstrates to the kids what he wants them to do. Expertise is a form of power. He demonstrates it, the kids look at it, and they say, yeah, I can do that, and they practice it, okay? That is one of the 5 freeing forms of power. Here's the biggie, the controlling forms. The coach has position power, right?
Mm-hmm.
With position power, they get reward and coercion power. They can reward the kids who do things right by letting them play. They can bench them, punish them if they don't do what they're... So position, reward, and coercion power goes together. But here's the biggie. If you've got a coach out there who is abusing your kid, connection power is the bigger form of power. You have to go to the person who hired the coach. If that person supports the coach has connection power. Now, if you go to the person who has power over the coach and you lodge a complaint, you're going to reduce connection power. When you reduce connection power, you reduce the coach's position power. I mean, this is kind of theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
Let me take something a little more common sense.
Okay?
Let's say you're a father and a mother, and you have 3 kids, okay? Mother is chastising one of the kids and says, I'm going to tell Dad what you just did. Okay? So Mom goes to Dad and says, you know what so-and-so did? And Dad says, what do you mean? What's wrong with that? You shouldn't have got him on about that. What happens to Mom's position power when Dad does not support Mom?
Mm-hmm.
Connection power is the most important thing when it comes to position power. If you don't have connection power, you don't have position power, and you lose your ability to reward and coerce. It's important for an educator, a teacher, or a principal. For example, all people have 5 basic needs. A baby who is born wants to be alive. The next need that comes into that baby's existence is, are they nurtured? Does somebody care about them? The next thing that comes in is, does the baby have control? These are your needs as well. You want to be alive. You want people to care about you. You want to have some control. The next thing that comes into existence is there purpose? Is there a purpose in your life? If you're alive, if you're cared for, if you have control and you have a purpose, you're going to be happy. Life's 5 basic needs. All coaches try to meet those five basic needs. All teachers should try to meet those life's five basic needs. All principals should meet those life's five basic needs with their students and with their teachers. If they do, test scores are going to improve. If a coach meets those five basic needs, the kids are going to be highly motivated. They're going to work their butts off to win.
However, you may have a situation, and I'm sure this exists in places, where you have a coach who is a bully, but he's also has 17 straight winning seasons, so they want to leave him alone.
Yeah, that is true.
So then you're a parent, you have a child who's in a tough situation, and your power is really limited. Then it's a tough situation to be in. And are there any ways around that other than, you know, asking your kid to take up something else?
You've touched on a very strange situation. Well, let me give you an example of a real-life situation. I was interviewing for a superintendent of a school district in Kentucky. And they told me that one of my jobs that I would have to do in my first year was to fire the head football coach. They didn't like him, but he had won the state championship. And he was a bully. Mm-hmm. And I says, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I won't do that. So I didn't get the job. I knew if I fired the head football coach, the next person to get fired was going to be me. So I wouldn't do that. Yeah. So I go back to the five basic needs. Now, With the bully, it's all about control. The bully takes control away from the victim, okay? For some reason, a bully has a high need to control.
You said that a lot of coaches, that coaching is changing. A lot more coaches are going away from the tyrant and to the all-for-one and one-for-all model. Do you see that as continuing? Do you see that as it becomes more successful, as, you know, that's just going to be the way it is?
Well, I'm on a mission to change the way board members treat superintendents and superintendents treat principals and principals treat teachers. Give control without giving it up is the only way to go. Let me give you one example of that.
Sure.
Here's what the coach should do to give another way the coach can give control without giving it up. Coach Barrett is a great basketball coach because, right, complete that sentence as many times as you want. So the kids get this sentence, Coach Barrett is a great basketball coach because. Complete that many times as they want. So they're going to write down all the things that they see the coach doing well. The second sentence is, Coach Barrett would be a better basketball coach if. So the kids write down all the things they think the coach could do to be a better coach. We call this force field analysis. You identify those forces you've got going for you and those forces that you could improve on. And you get back from the players all the things that you are doing well and the things they think you could do better. What it says is, the coach says to the kids, guys, I'm listening to you. I care about you. I want to know what you think. I trust you. I'm going to take this risk to find out what you really think of the way I coach. I know of a few teachers who go to the kids and say, you're a great teacher because you'd be a better teacher if. Do you come across as someone who is self-serving or a servant leader? The concept that has to go with anyone who's in a leadership position is they are there to serve.
Again, the name of Dr. Cleet Bulach's book is Creating a Culture for High-Performing Schools, a Comprehensive Approach to School Reform and Dropout Prevention. Still to come, a proposed charter school in North Carolina has community members choosing sides. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1147.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A new charter school may open in Chapel Hill, North Carolina next year. If approved by the State Board of Education, the Howard and Lillian Lee Scholars Academy would open in a new building and serve students in kindergarten through fifth grade, with possible expansion into middle school down the road. Its stated mission is to close the achievement gap to help African American students raise their performances on standardized tests. The hope is that, in turn, that will improve graduation rates and lead to greater college readiness. The Lee Charter School proposal is causing educators and parents in Chapel Hill to pick sides, splitting a community that places a high value on public education. From Chapel Hill, Dave DeWitt has a report.
By almost any measure, the Chapel Hill Carborough schools are the best in the state. The students there score the highest on tests, they earn awards and win academic contests. The district taxes more and pays the most for their teachers. They offer Chinese immersion in elementary school and a wide array of AP courses in high school. But one problem has been persistent, the achievement gap between white and black students. And that's what Angela Lee wants to fix.
We believe that the students that we particularly want to see succeed, really do their best and achieve their potential, may do better in the charter school environment.
Angela Lee is spearheading the effort to create the Howard and Lillian Lee Scholars Academy. It's named after her parents. Howard was the first African-American mayor of Chapel Hill and is the former chair of the state school board, and why that's important will be clear in a moment. Lillian spent 3 decades as an educator in the Chapel Hill public schools. Angela Lee says parents in and around Chapel Hill are anxious for her school to open, but there are some in town who aren't.
And I don't see taking that kind of money out of the school system will benefit the educational process here in Chapel Hill Carver.
Reverend Robert Campbell is with the Chapel Hill branch of the NAACP. He points out that the achievement gap has, in fact, closed in recent years in the district. African-American students in Chapel Hill also outperform African-American students throughout the state. But Campbell's concerns go beyond just test scores. He says if the charter school opens with its goal of 400-plus students, and most of them are African-American, in the relatively small Chapel Hill Carborough School District, it will create a two-tiered system along racial lines, with white students in the public schools and black students in the charter school.
We are creating a freestanding institution that is creating a form of segregation.
When the Lee Charter School proposal first landed on Tom Forcella's desk, he had a similar reaction. He's been the superintendent in Chapel Hill for less than a year and worries what will happen if his budget loses $2 to $4 million in per pupil funding.
Will there be some savings because you'll need less staff if that many students do go? Some, but it doesn't equate to the amount of money that we would probably lose.
The Chapel Hill schools may be forced to cut some long-standing and effective programs that serve minority and low-income students. And Forcella, who came here from Connecticut, also wonders why the system is designed to be so antagonistic.
There's never, as part of the process, a preliminary conversation between the individuals who want to start a charter school and the public school.
Doing battle with the public schools and the NAACP is not what those behind the Lee Charter Schools say they want to be doing. Danita Mason-Hogans is on the school's board of directors. She says the school will not target just African-American children.
We don't want African-American, white students or anyone else to stay in a public school system that's not working for them. So for us, the larger issue and the bigger picture is offering an alternative for those students.
The topic of possible segregation didn't come up when a state school board committee discussed fast-track approval for the Lee Charter School last month. The members were more concerned with how the school would build a new building in just 5 months in Chapel Hill, a notoriously difficult place to build. And they also asked questions about the for-profit company that will manage the school, National Heritage Academies. But even those concerns are unlikely to overcome politics. Howard Lee once sat where they are now, on the State School Board of Education, and he still wields tremendous influence. Enough that a charter school bearing his name very likely will be approved when the full board votes on March 1st. How the school, and the fight to get it started, will affect Howard Lee's legacy is less certain. Dave DeWitt, North Carolina Public Radio.
Many companies around the world are making an effort to go green. And in addition to all the environmental advantages, there's another one. It's profitable. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Sometimes making economic choices based on what's best for the environment can come at an additional cost. But as Erica Marciak, instructor of information technology and decision sciences at Old Dominion University, explains, many companies are discovering that being green can help keep them out of the red.
When I tell people what I do, their most common response is, "And what exactly is green supply chain management?" The short of it is that green supply chain management tries to reduce the environmental impacts of making, transporting, using, and then disposing of stuff. The long of it, well, let's just say there are a lot of things involved in making that happen. Because when you're trying to address environmental issues, you can't just look at how things are made, or moved, or used, or thrown away. You have to look at all those things at the same time. For example, I could own a gas guzzler for a car, but if I only drive it 2,000 miles a year, I'm going to make less of an environmental impact than if I own a gas sipper and drive it 50,000 miles a year. Taking a comprehensive perspective is very important when working on green supply chains. Many companies used to think that focusing on environmental issues was a waste of time and money, so they either didn't do it, or they only did it when they had to. But soon, they began to realize that being green could actually be strategic, and not only save environmental resources, but also save money in the long term. At the same time, many consumers were changing what they valued in products and services, and they began to realize that if they wanted to make less of an environmental footprint, then the products and services they bought and used would also have to change. Today's top companies use environmental issues as an opportunity to make themselves better. And that's why green isn't just good for the environment, but good for business too.
That was Erica Marciak of Old Dominion University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.